Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's discussions about possibly waiving dockage fees for local vessels.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
With an eye on supporting education, waterfront activity, and tourism, Council unanimously voted at their last meeting on Tuesday to explore options to waive or discount dockage fees at city-operated marinas and ports, specifically for vessels that contribute to community and tourism events or that offer free educational or public programming. The motion brought forward by Councillor Don Amos specifically references the tall ship St. Lawrence II, based out of Portsmouth Olympic Harbor. The ship, which calls Kingston's waterfront home, offers hands-on experiential education programs. Chris Chafe, Executive Director of Tallship Expeditions Canada Brigantine, came before Council to speak on behalf of the program and its impact.
Over the years, our community has grown increasingly distant from the water as a result of ever-compounding barriers to access. Even low-barrier avenues have become prohibitively expensive and are often viewed as not for them by some economically disadvantaged and racialized Kingstonians. Half the youth we serve have never been on the water. This is a trend we want to see reversed by breaking down those barriers and enabling access for underserved members of our community. The lake isn't just a pretty backdrop. It isn't just a racetrack for wealthy sailors, nor is it a fishing pond for the well-to-do. The lake is the biggest public space we have and should be available to everyone. We've made an offer to staff to operate a barrier-free sailing and water access program to the community, as well as to open a boater and education space available to boaters and visitors at POH and the community more broadly in the past OLS location. The city recently made a sizable investment in that space to support the sleeping cabin project, which has now been sitting vacant for 2 years. We are offering the opportunity to breathe new life into a space by opening it to the public. It's been difficult for us to understand the city's position on mooring fees. All the ports we visit, Thunder Bay, St. John's, New York City, Halifax, Yananaque, and over a month in Lunenburg, all of these spaces were provided free of charge, and they were very happy to have us there, right, to open up the boat, to have youth engage with the ship. The only exception seems to be Kingston.
City staff are already in the process of reviewing Portsmouth Olympic Harbor as part of a broader visioning process. That work is focused on aligning site uses with Kingston's waterfront, supporting sailing, water sports, community access, and other opportunities. In bringing the motion forward, Councillor Amos pointed to the role tall ships and other specialty vessels play in strengthening Kingston's tourism profile, supporting waterfront activity, and fostering community pride. He also noted that other Canadian ports and marinas, such as Halifax and St. John's, already have programs in place that waive or reduce docking fees for educational and charitable vessels in recognition of their public value.
If you think of the 1800s, our waterfront was plastered with these type of ships, and now we don't have that. We don't have this type of ship that's coming into our ports very often, and this is a tourism opportunity for us. This is an opportunity for people to come out onto the dock, jump on the boat, see what a tall ship is about, and it's done for free. So it's something that our downtown tourism can sink their teeth into. It's something that if you're new to Kingston, if you're new to the country, and you're not familiar with the tall ships, you can see one that's actually working. And then any youth who has any sort of curiosity about our water and wants to see what a tall ship is about, what a great opportunity to come down with your family and have a tour of the boat and see what it's about. This, as we heard from our delegation today, that boat travels all over Eastern Ontario, well, all over Ontario, really, Lake Ontario, and then through the Atlantic Ocean, from New York City to Halifax and everywhere along the Eastern Seaboard. This is an opportunity for us to really lean into our tall ship experience here in Kingston. This is its home dock. This is an opportunity for us to really bring something forward where the public can enjoy it and Kingston can take pride in it. You heard the captain speak. He is now going to be going through Tourism Kingston, and it'll be representing us at other ports. We need to embrace at our end its home port and what we can do for it. We are a city that says we thrive on history and innovation. History is here, and we have an opportunity to support it and let it thrive.
With council support, city staff are set to report back to council in the second quarter of 2026, with options for implementing fee waivers or cost reductions at city-operated marinas, along with an analysis of the financial costs and benefits to the city. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about TLTI Council's approval of new recycling depot changes.
Thank you, Jesse. The Township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands Council has unanimously approved a series of waste management measures that will reshape how recycling and household garbage are handled across the township beginning in 2026. The decision authorizes staff to sign a change order with Circular Materials Ontario to renew the township's depot operations agreement for up to three additional one-year terms. The move comes as the province's shift to the extended producer responsibility model takes full effect on January 1st, 2026, transferring financial and operational control of Blue Box Recycling from municipalities to producers. Under the renewed agreement, TLTI would continue operating its three recycling depots, Lansdowne, Escott, and Briar Hill, but at a significantly reduced compensation rate from CMO. Revenue is projected to drop by roughly 43% next year, with an estimated $189,462 in 2025 to $108,600 in 2026. Council also directed staff to establish a dedicated recycling depot for non-eligible sources, such as churches, daycares, not-for-profits, commercial farms, campgrounds, and municipal facilities, which producers are no longer required to service under the new rules. Councillor Angela Kelman raised concerns about how the township would determine whether material arriving at the depot was coming from a residence or from a non-eligible source. Rather than operating separate bins at all three depots, an option staff estimated would cost roughly $25,000 per site annually, council opted to centralize non-eligible recycling drop-off at the Lansdowne landfill. Council further directed the Operations and Infrastructure Department to conduct a financial and operational review of introducing township-wide curbside collection for household garbage, which is currently delivered to landfill sites by residents. Mayor Karina Smith-Gatsky emphasized that the decision simply gives staff the authority to gather facts before council makes any major commitments. The municipality's recycling program is in a period of rapid change. Under the province's EPR framework, CMO will assume full responsibility for residential blue box recycling as of January 1st. Municipalities can continue to operate depots, but at standardized and significantly lower rates. Staff noted that if TLTI declined to sign the change order, CMO would still require the township to operate depots without compensation, or alternatively, TLTI could cease operating recycling depots entirely, forcing residents to travel to the nearest site in front of Yonge. Staff described both alternatives as unworkable. The 2026 operating budget already accounts for reduced recycling revenues and the costs associated with the non-eligible materials depot in Lansdowne. Staff will report back next year on the feasibility of a curbside garbage collection program, including potential cost savings and operational impacts. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJI reporter for the Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forstell, about an arbitration decision related to the Queen's University Faculty Association.
Thank you, Dinah. An arbitrator has partially upheld a grievance filed by the Queen's University Faculty Association, or QFA, over the university's requirement that faculty install third-party security software on any device used for work. After reviewing submissions from both sides and holding a hearing in Kingston on November 4th, arbitrator William Kaplan ruled on November 7th that the grievance was justified, in part. The decision directs Queen's to make several significant changes affecting device reimbursement, cybersecurity protocols, and the implementation of technological changes. According to the decision, CUFA's grievance was filed when the university administration adopted a new rule requiring faculty members to install third-party monitoring software. CUFA argued the policy was unreasonable, violated academic freedom and privacy rights, and ignored the need for transparency and meaningful consultation. The grievance also claimed the requirement conflicted with several articles of the collective agreement, including provisions addressing discipline, privacy, and decision-making through joint committees. CUFA also noted that the administration had admitted more work was needed to ensure transparency and informed consent, yet it still went ahead with the new rule regardless. According to CUFA, this was unreasonable and an improper use of management authority. Lastly, CUFA considered the policy unreasonable because it did not account for the special privacy concerns in a university setting, where the free exchange of ideas through teaching and research is essential. CUFA said the administration's unilateral action also ignored the fact that faculty have a reasonable expectation of privacy on any device they use for work, no matter who paid for it. One significant component of Kaplan's ruling directs all Queen's faculties and departments to reimburse faculty members for purchasing devices, including mobile phone upgrades, through existing professional expense accounts. The ruling clarifies that term adjunct faculty are also entitled to these reimbursements and that their expense funds must be released early in the academic term once the required forms are submitted. The decision also requires the creation of a new Standing Joint Committee on Technology, SJCT. The committee will include three CUFA-appointed faculty members, the university's chief information officer, and two representatives appointed by the Queen's provost. Beginning in January 2026, the committee will meet quarterly to discuss technology issues affecting working conditions. In addition, Queen's must now provide the committee with a detailed written report every quarter outlining all security threats detected by this software that will require university intervention. The report must include sufficient detail to provide the committee with complete transparency into the nature of each threat and the university's response. Under the ruling, Queen's Information Technology, or IT Services, must hold in-person information sessions for CUFA members at least 4 months before introducing new, major technological requirements. These sessions must allow for questions and meaningful dialogue. All significant technology changes must also be discussed at both the new SJCT and the Joint Committee to Administer the Agreement, JCAA, levels. The arbitrator also ordered Queen's to consult with CUFA before finalizing several key policies, including the new Exceptional Access Authorization Procedure and the Cybersecurity Policy for Faculty. Consultation is also required before renewing the Electronic Monitoring Transparency Policy in 2027. Within 30 days, CUFA and the university must attempt to agree on an external provider to conduct a new privacy impact assessment of the software used. If they cannot agree, Kaplan will choose the provider from a list of names submitted by both parties. The assessment must focus on the protection of personal, research, and intellectual property data. The results must be shared with CUFA, and Queen's must consult on any recommended changes. Kaplan concluded by stating that he will remain seized of the matter, meaning he will stay involved to help resolve any disputes over the implementation of his ruling.
Thank you, Jesse. Now over to the LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the reduction of a proposed residential tax rate in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
this week. Loyalist Township held its second of three budget meetings and saw the proposed residential tax rate increase drop to 3.64%. The first meeting saw a proposed 4.97%, but members of the committee said they wanted to see it under 4%. The township's director of finance and treasurer, David Clazy, explains how they came to the new number.
We've been made aware of some additional supplementary assessment through MPAC. And as well, we have also received the final 2026 assessment rule at the end of last week. So in conjunction with that new assessment, that will generate an additional $165,000 in new taxation revenue, which has the potential alone of decreasing our tax requirement by 0.7%. So when you basically put those all together, that has a net reduction in the tax levy requirement of $303,000. We're now looking at a revised residential tax increase of 3.64%. So that results in a $24.457 million of tax levy requirement. And again, the amount of debt and the contributions to capital is unchanged from the previous day.
The township's third and final 2026 budget meeting will take place December 2nd.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about the Swana Arts and Cultural Festival in Prince Edward County.
From the minute I took my shoes off, respecting the Swana culture, the vibe was lively with kids running around and infectious music welcoming me. Saturday was the first of hopefully many Swana Prince Edward County Arts and Cultural Festivals, celebrating the traditions and customs of Southwestern Asia and North Africa. Organizer Cami Abrahamian guided me through the displays and activities and let me loose to explore everything Swana. The family-friendly event had something for everyone. Kids lined up for face painting while others took part in an Armenian embroidery lesson or culinary class. Families relaxed in the traditional living room setting, enjoying regional food and coffees, while tired out kids could lounge in the cool down tent. I could barely stop moving to the regional music while admiring and sampling the magnificent cakes. I've never seen anything like these cakes, so beautiful. It was a shame to cut into them, but they were delicious. Cami Abrahamian tells us more.
Who am I speaking with today?
My name is Cami Abrahamian.
And what is this event?
It is the Swana PEC Arts and Culture Festival. It is the first of its kind in Prince Edward County, and it is basically a gathering around Swana culture and art and music and food, so much food. And basically we wanted to make people feel like they were walking into a Swana person's home. When I say Swana, I mean Southwest Asian, North African, which is an anti-colonial term for what other people know as the Middle East.
And so what countries would that include?
Oh my goodness, the long list. Armenia, Turkey, Azerbaijan, Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Sudan. Oh my God, there's so many more that I'm missing. Kurdistan, Georgia, Libya, Palestine, Lebanon. There are more.
That's okay.
There are more.
That's okay. Yeah. That sounds good. Is there a particular religion to this celebration today, or just the culture?
Just culture. Yeah, there's many, many religions in that region, and this particular celebration is not religious specific. It makes space for all the diversity of cultures, to represent all the diversity of cultures and religions, but it is not a religious gathering at all. No. And actually, like, that region is very well known for its diversity in culture, in ethnicity, in tribes, in religion, and for a very long time they cohabitated in perfect harmony, you know, until other folks came through.
Right.
Yeah, pitted us against each other, but for the most part, what we wanted to do with this event is really We wanted to share Swana culture and celebrate Swana culture. It's been a rough couple of years, as you know, with everything that's happening in Gaza and the war in Artsakh and even in Sudan. It's been a rough few years. I mean, it's been rough for a long time for people for that region, but it's been a particularly rough couple of years with the genocide especially. And we really just wanted a moment to just celebrate because our culture is so rich and so diverse and so generous, and we wanted to just take a minute to celebrate that instead of just being sad all the time.
Yes.
And share that with the community also.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
I'm not sure. I think I'm just really grateful to Prince Edward County for showing up for this. You know, we really didn't know what it was going to be like, but so many people have shown up, and that means a lot to me. I moved to Prince Edward County 8 years ago, and for me, I felt largely quite culturally isolated. There aren't a lot of Swana people here, but that didn't, over the years, I found some, and then over the years, you know, I realized that Prince Edward County is becoming this really diverse place, and we put this event on not just for locals, but also for tourists who are coming through to say, There are many different sides of PEC, you know, and we're here, and welcome to our home. We really wanted this to feel like people were walking into the home, right? So a lot of food, a lot of noise, a lot of chaos, a lot of hugging, right? So, yeah, that's why we put it on.
And music.
And music, exactly, dancing all the time, yeah. Thank you so much for coming.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, FrequencyNews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about ongoing budget negotiations between Cobourg City Council and the city's chief of police.
Cobourg Police Chief Paul Vandergraaff is once again defending his 2026 proposed budget, which would see a 20.5% increase from last year's budget. Vandergraaff went before Municipal Council Monday afternoon, stating there is zero discretionary funding and this budget reflects the true cost of policing. 911 dispatch fees with Owen Sound Police are going up. There is a 4% increase to staff wages and benefits, and some part-time hires are moving to full-time capacity. Of the approximate $12 million budget estimate, 81% will go to staff and wages. Court administration and security costs are going up as well. Vandergraaff said 11.5% of the budget will go to ensuring that investigations reach the conviction stage.
There's nowhere to cut. So in a year of 20.5%, sure would have been nice to lean that out to get you guys down to 16 or 15%. But unfortunately, over these years, to get to those numbers, we leaned out everything.
The Community Policing Act has required Cobourg Police to spend $900,000 to become compliant within the legislation. Increased costs for mental health training, more equipment, and updated armor for police cruisers are pushing up costs. For the past 10 years, Vandergraaff said police budgets have been operating in a deficit and that budgets have been very reliant on corporate services revenue. Vandergraaff explained that the budget of last year did not reflect what the cost of policing in Cobourg was, as the department dipped into its reserves to offset rising expenditures. Councillor Adam Bureau, who also sits on the Police Services Board, said this budget is a catch-up from previous budget mistakes.
Yes, this is the catch-up year for all of those years of mistakes, of maybe we should have had the 3% or 4%. There were so many compiling factors that are happening in this budget right now.
Bureau explained that he anticipates the proposed budget for 2027 would be in the single digits. The number of police calls are going up, as too is the staffing requirements per shift. If the 20.5% budget is passed, it would mean a 4.8% tax increase on the town budget. If not passed, conciliation and arbitration are options. The meeting at one point devolved as Mayor Lucas Cleveland wanted Vandergraaff to address, quote, allegations of financial mismanagement by the police board in previous years. Bureau and Vandergraaff both took responsibility for the current budget situation, with Vandergraaff adding that he believes the police board too is owning up to its participation. Council took the presentation for information purposes and no decision on the police budget was made. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, December 11th, daytime high of minus 5, feeling closer to minus 8. Friday, December 12th, another minus 5 day, but about 4 degrees colder with an overnight low of minus 12. Saturday, December 13th, daytime high of minus 5, overnight low of minus 8. However, with the wind chill, it will feel closer to minus 12. Sunday, December 14th, daytime high of minus 4, overnight low of minus 10. And then kicking off next week, Monday, December 15th, daytime high of minus 5 with an overnight low of minus 13. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Reminder that winter parking restrictions are in place as of December 1st. During December and March, overnight street parking will be banned only if the weather conditions require it. During January and February, overnight on-street parking is not permitted no matter the weather conditions. With construction season winding down, there are fewer road closures than you would typically expect. Here are three relevant road closures in the Kingston area. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess 2 Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. And Berry Street, Queen 2 Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bayridge Drive, Milford to Henderson. Expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Catwoods Drive, Centennial to Gardner's. Expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes the site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.